What is so threatening about free expression? The writer Salman Rushdie, speaking last year at the New York Public Library, offered this answer. He said, in a world of increasing authoritarianism, quote, writing at its best has freedom. It belongs only to the artist.
I think that's one reason why authoritarian regimes have so often gone after poets and novelists, you know, people who have no armies, you know, people who often don't even command gigantic crowds, you know, and yet the danger of the voice speaking freely and refusing to accept the narrative that power wishes to lay down for us, that's seen to be dangerous.
1 week ago, Salman Rushdie was brutally attacked while on stage in Western New York State. He remains in critical condition. His attacker expressed admiration for the late Iranian leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who more than 30 years ago had called for Rushdie's death. And while the Iranian government denied any involvement in last week's attack, the vitriol against Rushdie in Iran has not abated. On Monday of this week, Mohammad Sadegh Kushki, on the Faculty of Law and Political Science at the University of Tehran, said on Iranian television, quote, people like Rushdie who want to do such a stupid thing will not dare from now on. Khomeini had the wisdom to issue this verdict back then, Kushki said on Iranian TV. Quote, Rushdie will go to hell. We don't want anyone else to dare so similar acts of insolence. Look, we respond to ideas with ideas, but when insults are hurled, we respond according to the law. According to Islamic law, apostates are sentenced to execution, end quote. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Truth has always been a battle, Salman Rushdie once said. He believes that battle is more intense today than it has ever been. So we're going to take a look at the long struggle over freedom of speech and expression, the history of how people fought to protect their ability to speak, and the price they have paid for centuries. And we'll begin with more on Salman Rushdie. Suzanne Nossel is CEO of the American chapter of the Worldwide Writers Association, PEN. She's known Salman Rushdie for a decade, and they were emailing each other on the morning that Rushdie was attacked. She told us about the books that first brought him global acclaim and then condemnation.
He had kind of a breakout success in the early 1980s with the novel Midnight's Children that won the Booker Prize, which is one of the most prestigious international prizes for a literary work, and he continued to be prolific. And then in 1988, he published The Satanic Verses, a novel that includes episodes based on Muhammad's life. And that book sparked a firestorm.
Parts of the Islamic world believed that Rushdie's depiction of a character based on Muhammad was an insult to the prophet. Protests, some deadly, broke out in India, Pakistan, England, and other nations. And then, in 1989, Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa calling Muslims everywhere and anywhere to kill Rushdie and anyone associated with his book. Salman Rushdie was forced into hiding for more than a decade.
Bookstores were targeted for carrying the Satanic Verses. One of the translators of the book in Japan was assassinated because of his role in bringing the book to a public. And so it was this earth-shattering event in the literary world, and very prominent writers rallied around Salman Rushdie. And it was a kind of a cause where he was seen as, you know, standing for everyone who takes the risk of telling the stories that they want to tell and then may have to pay a price for it.
In 2013, I actually had a chance to speak with Salman Rushdie, and he told me that even though British police provided him with protection for years, he had also come under blistering criticism from many leaders in the West.
A kind of religious gang, you know. So if you were to look at the religious leaders, not just in England, You know, I mean, yes, in England there was this unfortunate remark by the Archbishop of Canterbury, but also by the chief rabbi of Britain. Meanwhile, something very similar was being said by the Cardinal of New York, you know, by Jimmy Carter. This group of people who all believe in different religions, you know, when a religion says it's under attack, they all join up. They all join up on that team.
And the God Squad, as
the God Squad.
Them.
I'm afraid it really exists, and it made me feel even more contemptuous of it than I did before.
That was a conversation I had with Salman Rushdie in 2013, because by 1998, the danger to Rushdie's life seemed to wane. The Iranian government said it would not threaten his life, nor encourage others to. And again, here's Penn America CEO Suzanne Nossel.
Rushdie came to live more out in the open. He moved to New York City. He became the president and board chair of the organization I work with, Penn America, and became a firm fixture in the literary culture of New York City and the world, speaking at literary events, very prolific with his writing, many more novels.
Then, in 2015, terrorists attacked the offices of the French satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. The magazine had published cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The gunmen claimed they were members of an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group, and they murdered 12 cartoonists, editors, and writers.
So what happened was, at Penn America, we made the decision right after the attack that we were going to give a Freedom of Expression Courage Award to the surviving staff of Charlie Hebdo. And it's an award that we present every year at our annual gala. And we were getting ready for the gala. It was about a week away. And suddenly we began to hear from writers who thought this award should not be conferred. They were concerned that Charlie Hebdo was a racist magazine, was Islamophobic, and didn't deserve to be honored in this way. And Salman had a very strong reaction to that.
Charlie Hebdo attacked everything. It attacked Muslims, attacked the Pope, it attacked the Israel rabbis, it attacked black people and white people and gay people and straight people. It attacked every kind of human being because what? It was making fun. Its strategy was to make fun of people. But the fact that you dislike them has got nothing to do with their right to speak. The fact that you dislike them certainly doesn't in any way excuse their murder. And now, the moment somebody says, yes, I believe in free speech, but I stop listening. No. Yes. You know, I believe in free speech, but people should behave themselves. I believe in free speech, but we shouldn't upset anybody. I believe in free speech, but let's not go too far. The point about it is the moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech. The point about it is that it's free.
Salman Rushdie in 2015. Well, last Friday morning, Salman Rushdie was attacked by a knife-wielding fanatic in New York State. On that day, that very morning, Suzanne Nossel was exchanging emails with her friend.
A few hours later, I was just absolutely stunned to hear about the attack. I mean, I really thought it was something in the past. I couldn't fathom that there were people still ready and willing to carry out such a threat. And so I think he did not live in fear, and I did not live in fear for him.
Suzanne Nossel, CEO of Penn America. Well, joining us now is Jacob Mushangama. He's a lawyer, human rights advocate, and executive director of the Copenhagen-based think tank Justitia. He's also author of Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. And he also hosts the podcast Clear and Present Danger, A History of Free Speech. Jacob, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be on.
What was your first reaction when you learned of the brutal attack against Salman Rushdie a week ago today?
Well, initially I was shocked and saddened and afraid for Rushdie's life. But after a few sort of minutes, I actually thought that the most surprising thing about the attack was that it had taken 32 or 33 years for a fundamentalist to get to Rushdie, because the list of people who have been attacked or killed for their involvement with the satanic verses is very long and bloody indeed, going back all the way to 1988 and now culminating in this attack on Rushdie. And as you mentioned, there's also been the Charlie Hebdo affair, and the Charlie Hebdo affair really was due to events in Copenhagen in 2005, where a Danish newspaper published cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that unleashed a firestorm of protests and threats. And Charlie Hebdo, as one of few magazines, showed solidarity with the Danish newspaper and republished these cartoons. And that's really what made them a target for a fundamentalist. So these events are linked, and the threat has been real for a very long time. We also saw in 2020 a French school teacher who taught his class about free expression, where he showed cartoons to sort of explain what is this controversy about, and he was beheaded brutally on the street by a fundamentalist. So in that sense, it's unfortunately not surprising that Rushdie was attacked. Although, of course, you would have hoped that security could have protected him.
Hmm. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a great deal more about the long path of the fight to protect free expression around the world. And we'll be doing that with Jacob Mushangama, who's joining us today, by the way, from Reykjavik in Iceland. And by the way, I mentioned a few minutes ago that I had a chance to speak with Salman Rushdie right here in these very studios in 2013. He had been on the tail end of a book tour for his memoir, where he was recounting his years in hiding. So we've pulled that conversation, that 2013 conversation, out of our archives and put it up in our podcast feed, the On Point podcast feed. You should definitely listen to it, because there's a great deal of detail that Rushdie goes into about what it was like to be in hiding for more than a decade. So subscribe to the On Point podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're joined by Jacob Mushangama. He is the author of Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. He also hosts the podcast Clear and Present Danger, A History of Free Speech, and he joins us today from Reykjavik in Iceland. Jacob, before we leave the immediacy of the story of Salman Rushdie in order to explore this longer history that you've written about, I'm wondering if you could actually just remind listeners who don't recall, what was it about the Satanic Verses, Rushdie's 1988 book, that was so controversial in parts of the Islamic world?
Yeah, well, it's that the novel is seen to poke fun at a thinly veiled character, a character thinly veiled as the Prophet Muhammad, who is not to be mocked. In fact, we have there are a number of so-called hadiths, sort of supposedly authoritative histories about the Prophet, where he has people orders people killed for poking fun at him, including poets. So some Muslims take that extremely serious. Obviously, not all. But I think it is also clear to say that a lot of people had not read the satanic verses. So I don't think a lot of the people who would protest or even issue death threats had done a close sort of literary analysis of the satanic verses, which is, not only poking fun at Islam. It's a complex literary work, but poking fun at the Prophet is serious to fundamentalists.
Right. I mean, I think I recall reading that even Khomeini may have not himself read the satanic verses before issuing a fatwa calling for Rushdie's death. Now, I've got some lines from the satanic verses here in front of me because, as you pointed out, Jacob, there's a character that's a thinly veiled representation of the Prophet Muhammad. The character in the book is called Mahound. And there's at least one scene in which another character is speaking to Mahound and talking about how the fact that Mahound brought humanity this deeper truth, and that deeper truth was the devil himself. And then Mahound responds saying, yes, it was a wonderful thing I did. I brought you the devil. That sounds like me. So it's passages like that that sparked the extreme anger of Khomeini and other parts of the Islamic world. Now, that understanding that is important because in your book, you write about how the perception of blasphemy or the belief in blasphemy is central to the centuries-long attempts for leaders to try and inhibit freedom of expression.
Yes, you could go all the way back to the trial of Socrates. So one of the charges is that he had introduced new deities into the Athenian religion that were not recognized. And even though Athens is also the home where free speech originated, something akin to blasphemy could, under specific circumstances, be a step too far for the Athenians, and that was one of the reasons why even Socrates was killed. And then when the Roman Republic adopts Christianity as its state religion, and when you have monotheism, both Christianity and Islam comes along, you have very strict blasphemy norms. You also have that in Judaism, and so the fight to challenge religious norms is a long and bloody one, and is intertwined deeply with the larger struggle to be able to think and write freely about about both religion, but also really politics. What I think is both interesting and a little bit sad is that in Persia, which in modern day Iran, you actually had some of the Middle Ages' most daring free thinkers who were Muslims. Someone like Al-Razi, and Al-Razi was someone who said that reason should govern and not be governed, should control and not be controlled. And he warned, and this is more than 1,000 years ago, he said that if the people of a given religion are asked about the proof for the soundness of their religion, they flare up, get angry, and spill the blood of whoever confronts them with this question. They forbid rational speculation and strive to kill their adversaries. This is why truth became thoroughly silenced and concealed. Now, that sounds almost like Salman Rushdie today. And so this is a person who was born and lived in what is modern day Iran, but whose values are very different from those who adopted by the theocratic state of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yeah. So this concept of blasphemy, though, is it basically a tool that was used by state authorities throughout time, because those authorities essentially use religion as a means to both set laws, to create social norms, et cetera, to wield the state's power. So is it only blasphemy, not just because it's dares to challenge the religion, but, you heard Rushdie say at the very, very top of the show that it dares to challenge the power of the state?
Sure, you see that with Khomeini. So he was the head of a Shia state, and he sort of I think, latched on to the Rushdie controversy to show that Shia Iran was sort of at the forefront of fighting for the honor of the Prophet. So also as a geopolitical ploy to become the leader of the Muslim world, even though the majority of Muslim states are Sunnis. But I think we should not underestimate also that, you know, in a lot of countries, and this is still the case, but, you know, religious ideals are powerfully held by people. So there's no doubt that many people throughout the ages have genuinely felt that an attack on holy ideas was akin to physical violence. There was this idea centuries ago, for instance, in Europe, that if you attacked Christianity, central tenets of Christianity, God might react with divine intervention. And also Christianity was what held society together. So you could not allow whether heretics or blasphemers to speak freely, because it would not only endanger their own souls, but it would endanger the entire community of believers in Christendom.
Yeah.
But it's also true that leaders have certainly used that as a very powerful tool to shore up their own authority, because if they are seen as the true representatives of Orthodox religion, well, then criticizing them might be akin to criticizing religion. Mm-hmm. And so blasphemy becomes both a secular and a political crime.
Ah, okay. Now, there are many places around the world where there still are blasphemy laws. I believe even in Denmark, you're based in Copenhagen most of the time. Are there blasphemy laws still on the book in Denmark?
No, actually, we led a successful campaign in 2017 to have it abolished. When it was just about to be enforced for the first time, I think, in more than 40 years. So I think all Nordic countries, bar Finland, have now decriminalized blasphemy. But it's, you know, in Austria, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a woman who said something derogatory about the Prophet Muhammad, and she was fined, and she took her case to the European Court of Human Rights. And the European Court of Human Rights said that freedom of expression did not protect her right to insult her religious feelings. So even though the penalties meted out by Austria are very, very different from those you would be on the receiving end of in Iran, you know, even in some democracies, there are limits on what you can say about religion.
Mm. So, I mean, we've been focusing on the religious aspect of the centuries-long battle for free expression here. But Rushdie himself, just a couple of weeks ago, 2 weeks before he was attacked, he gave an interview to a German news magazine. And in that interview, he had said that he doesn't think that religious fanaticism is necessarily the greatest threat to freedom of expression worldwide now. I mean, he talked about, again, to this German news magazine, he said the biggest danger facing us now is the threat to losing democracy. And he pointed out what he called a kind of crypto-fascism seen in the United States. What do you make of that?
No, I definitely think that we're living through a free speech recession. So for more than a decade, perhaps even 15 years, free speech has been in recession globally. So and this includes open democracies, but of course you see it most dramatically in authoritarian and illiberal states. So, you know, the worst example being China, where that has invested billions and billions of billions of dollars into developing this technological dystopia, where citizens are subjected to extreme censorship and surveillance, and who are also exporting this blueprint of censorship to other states. And then you have sort of states like Hungary, where free speech is also under attack, but in less draconian ways than in China. And then you have the U.S. In the U.S. is an interesting case in the sense that the First Amendment provides what is probably the strongest legal protection of free speech in the history of humankind. It's a really strong legal protection of political speech. But the culture of free speech in the United States, I think, is eroding. And ultimately, I think that the culture of free speech is essential, is more important than legal standards. And what I mean by that is, if you have an intolerant culture towards social dissent, the legal limits are likely to be interpreted in a way that is intolerant.
Okay. So, because here in the United States, we have this shift in the culture of free speech that's coming from across the political spectrum, right? There are multiple examples today of books being removed from the library, from various libraries, from school libraries, from public libraries, because of the fact that they tell stories about the LGBTQ community or are seen as potentially disturbing to young people, et cetera. That kind of limiting on free speech comes from the right-hand side of the political spectrum here in the United States. There's also a pushback against free speech coming from the left. And in fact, it's something that Salman Rushdie himself was unafraid to talk about. I mean, here he is in a speech at Emory University in 2015, and he said, "These are not good days for liberty." And he talked about one of the kinds of threats to liberty he saw in the United States.
Even here, the classical values enshrined in the First Amendment are under attack by the rise of this new timid culture, which on the one hand more and more accepts the arguments of thin-skinned bigots that offense must be a limiting point on freedom. It seems to me that here in America, the danger to free expression is beginning to be greatest where it should be most defended. That's to say, within the walls of the academy. And the people most willing to sacrifice or limit this fundamental right are young people.
That's Salman Rushdie in 2015 at Emory University. Now, Jacob Mushangama, a few minutes ago when talking about sort of blasphemy laws and the threat that that the free expression from writers and artists posed to religious and state institutions, you had talked about how in the past the attack on those religious ideas was seen as akin to physical violence. And that really struck me because not infrequently from the political left in this country, we hear people saying words are violence. You know, criticism of various communities, et cetera, that those words are akin to violence. Is that all that different from the blasphemy pushback you were talking about earlier?
Well, there's a conceptual overlap, of course, if you really believe that words are akin to violence. But I don't know many examples of college students in the U.S. that, you know, physically attack a speaker, or at least not try to kill them in the same way that the sort of religious fundamentalists or jihadists do. So of course there's a difference in severity. But I agree. You know, so the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression in the U.S. has this scholars under fire, which documents a marked increase in the number of scholars on universities and colleges that have been disciplined or sanctioned or investigated for speech. And I think that stems from this phenomenon that Salman Rushdie was talking about. I think, ironically, it comes from good intentions. It comes from the fact that younger people in the U.S. are very concerned about tolerance and the flourishing of minorities. But they believe that free speech and equality are at some point mutually exclusive, whereas I would argue that the history of free speech shows that free speech and equality are mutually reinforcing. So that in fact free speech might be the most powerful engine of human equality that we've ever devised. It has been absolutely essential in the fight against slavery in the U.S. for the civil rights movement, for women's rights, for LGBT rights, and I think continues to be so. And then, you know, there's been, as you alluded to, there's been a conservative Republican pushback against that, and Suzanne Nossel, who PEN America has this great database that shows that documents sort of the Republican pushback with so-called educational gag orders that try to create these orthodoxies in higher education about, you know, critical race theory that you can't teach or use materials. And that sort of is a double whammy, a left-right hook against the idea of free speech in the U.S., which I think is likely to have long-term consequences because it's sort of caught in this moment of extreme political polarization and tribalism where political differences are so unforgiving that you can't really begrudge the other side free speech, even though it's such has become such a quintessential American value.
Well, I'm joined today by Jacob Mushangama. He's author of Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. He's also host of the podcast Clear and Present Danger, A History of Free Speech. And we've got some comments coming in online. Mary McAvenia says, in 1989, I took part in a public book reading from selected banned books in response to the fatwa against Rushdie. Back then, I had no idea that the political attitude of conservatives in the U.S. would shift to embrace the banning of books by 2020. I knew that if we said nothing and did nothing then, the clampdown on writers would only get fiercer, and so it has. Not enough of us stood up. Can we stand up now, or is it too late? More in a moment. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're joined by Jacob Mushangama. He's with us from Reykjavik in Iceland. He's author of Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. He also hosts the podcast Clear and Present Danger, A History of Free Speech. Jacob is also a lawyer and human rights advocate based in Copenhagen, Denmark. Now, Jacob, a couple of minutes ago, we heard from Pan America CEO Suzanne Nossel. And just as a reminder to folks, Pan America was founded back in 1922, and it's an organization that has worked since then to defend and celebrate the freedom of expression. And when the first fatwa, well, the fatwa that was issued against Salman Rushdie was put out by the Iran's Ayatollah in 1989, Pan America did a reading of the Satanic Verses as a means to defend Rushdie's right to speak. That happened back in 1989. And in fact, today, Suzanne Nossel and other prominent American writers are going to be gathering in New York City to once again do a public reading of the Satanic Verses. Now, I mention that because it's an example of Penn's long history of defending freedom of expression. But earlier, we heard in the show about the fact that in 2015, Pen America wanted to confer a Freedom of Expression Award to the French satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. And again, because members of Charlie Hebdo had been gunned down in their French offices after publishing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. But here's what's interesting. That same year, in 2015, Pan America got extreme pushback from some of this country's most famous writers. More than 200 of them wrote a letter to Pan America saying that they did not agree that this award, Freedom of Expression Award, should be given to Charlie Hebdo, and here's why. They accused Penn of, quote, valorizing selectively offensive material, material that intensifies the anti-Islamic, anti-Maghreb, anti-Arab sentiments already prevalent in the Western world. That letter came from the likes of writers Juno Diaz, Joyce Carol Oates, Michael Ondaatje, and many others. Interesting, because, of course, they had just written that letter not long after those members of Charlie Hebdo had been gunned down in their own offices. So we talked to Pen America CEO Suzanne Nossel, and we asked her what she thought about those objections.
We had to sort of take a pause and think, had we done something wrong? We had to dive deeply into what Charlie Hebdo really was about and look at the cartoons ourselves. And what we concluded is that genuinely, they are a satirical magazine. And if you understand the context of their cartoons and depictions, you recognize they are not pointing their fingers at the weak. They are not ridiculing people from minority groups. They're talking about the wider culture. They understand how power relations work. And we felt that the award was justified. And we wrote a piece in the New York Times setting out our argument for it, that Charlie Hebdo sort of patrolling the outer precincts of free speech and making the terrain safer for all of us.
But Suzanne Nossel says she understands that the writers who expressed their objection didn't like those outer precincts of free speech.
You know, not everybody agreed. And I also learned something from that. You know, I learned that even though if you do have all of the context and really have a chance to analyze these cartoons, that's one thing. But you also have to be cognizant of how people may react to them off the cuff, and an image that may offend someone who sees it in passing, you know, that's not necessarily something to discount. So we went forward with the award. There was a lot of security. There were threats. It was nerve-wracking, but we felt it had been a defensible decision.
So we asked Suzanne Nossel, what did she think about, or does she think about, people who believe today in the right to speak freely, but who had thought that Charlie Hebdo had gone too far?
I understand what they were thinking. I think it goes to a very deep tension that is part of our free speech discourse, which is the tension between the drive to become a more equal and inclusive society and the robust protection of free speech. And I do understand where they're coming from. You know, it was still in the long aftermath of 9/11 and the various wars. And so the idea that Muslims around the world were being targeted or ridiculed didn't sit well with people. And they didn't necessarily sort of have the time to probe into what was really behind this. They were worried about how it kind of came across. And I think they came from a good place, an earnest place with genuine concerns. And I hope in some of the debate, we made a little bit of progress in trying to explain, you know, how and why these values of inclusivity and equality and free expression can and must coexist.
Again, that's Suzanne Nossel, CEO of Pen America. So Jacob Mashangama, talk to me about what Nossel called the outer precincts of free speech. Because I think part of the what drives the contention over free expression century after century is that one's perception of where those outer precincts lie is very fluid. It changes over time.
Yeah. And I, you know, to be honest, you know, certainly Charlie Hebdo was fearless in, you know, taking on, you know, prime ministers, presidents, Catholic Church, Muslims, Jews, everyone. But I don't think they were pushing sort of the outer perimeters of free speech. In open democracies, you know, those who really push the boundaries of free speech are those, you know, who reject democratic values. You know, they are the sort of white supremacists or, you know, totalitarians who I believe it's also important to hold up their rights to free speech. So I think Charlie Hebdo was really sort of keeping alive a secularist tradition in France with the clear threats back to the Enlightenment of really ridiculing the powers that be, and I think that was worth lauding. Having said that, of course, it's completely legitimate to find Charlie Hebdo or any other expression distasteful or offensive. But what my big problem with that protest by authors is, these are people who exercise free speech for a living, and all of them, if you took up all of the authors that signed that protest, if you took what they'd written and been awarded for and lauded for, and you went back 100 or 200 years, what they wrote at the would have been probably banned or given rise to similar controversies at the time. So it's fine to say, I don't like Charlie Hebdo, but sort of protesting them in when they've just been, murdered, when someone responds to pens with AK-47s and then talk about inverted power relations, I found really, really astonishing. And let's not also forget that, blasphemy bans, many more Muslims are the targets of Islamic blasphemy bans mm-hmm. than non-Muslims. If we go back to the Salman Rushdie case, in 1989, there was a liberal imam in a mosque in Brussels who went on TV and sort of said that Muslims shouldn't react so forcefully, and he and a librarian at the mosque were gunned down and killed. If you go to a country like Pakistan today, there's a death penalty for blasphemy, and a number of university teachers and others have been targeted by these laws. So in that sense, the idea that rewarding someone for poking fun at Islamic dogmas is akin to Islamophobia or punching down on a vulnerable minority, I think misses the global context of what's going on in that era, especially in a digital world where cartoons published in Copenhagen are instantly available in Karachi or Cairo.
Right. Also, I mean, there is deep historical context here about the many examples that we can think of about how satirists in particular exercised a freedom of expression in order to speak truth to power that perhaps others could not. And it has been vital in sort of the a democratic pushback against an overextension of power. But what I'd love to hear from you, Jacob, is there's some interesting examples and unexpected examples in your book about how efforts to crack down on freedom of expression, even if well-intentioned, have actually backfired. And you point to Weimar Germany as an example?
Yes, that is obviously probably controversial, because Weimar Germany was the democratic republic that went before the Nazis in Germany, and in many ways was a vibrant place that protected free speech to a higher degree than what went before it. And the reason why, for instance, hate speech is banned in all European countries as opposed to under the First Amendment is because this belief in European democracies that the democracies must be militant and not tolerate the intolerant. So they have to crack down on the totalitarians before the totalitarians get into power. And I try to examine that argument and I show that in the Weimar Republic, there were a lot of laws that limited free speech, including that of Nazis. So someone like Hitler was given a speech ban in a number of German states. German states could administratively ban newspapers for weeks on a time for spreading false information or attacking the state. And so someone like Joseph Goebbels, who later became Minister of Propaganda, his Nazi newspaper was closed down, and he sort of used that to play the martyr and for propaganda, sort of saying, well, my newspaper is the most frequently banned in Germany. And even Julius Streicher, who was the editor of the most depraved anti-Semitic newspaper, Der Stürmer, was sentenced to prison for these anti-Semitic tropes and in Nuremberg. And then less than a year later, the Nazis increased their share of votes. But I think most ominously was the fact that the Nazis used the emergency laws and even emergency provisions of the Weimar Constitution that allowed to suspend free speech and other civil liberties. They used those, these provisions that were meant to protect democracies, they used them to abolish democracy. And so my argument is that very often the cure is worse than the disease. So yes, free speech can includes costs and harms, and especially in our digital age, you know, those harms and costs can be amplified through social media. Mm-hmm. But we also tend to take all the benefits for granted of free speech and focus only on the dark sides, and then we become tempted again and again to adopt these restrictive measures, even though history warns us that it is often dangerous and counterproductive. And what I admire especially about Salman Rushdie is many of the champions of free speech throughout history, someone like Voltaire or John Milton and others, suddenly often turn around and say, well, yes, free speech is important, but on this specific matter that I care deeply about, we must have restrictions. Salman Rushdie is a very different beast. He really stands up for principled, hard-nosed protection of free speech. I remember, I think there was a case where some people in London were protesting with these placards that said, behead those who insult Islam. And I think Rushdie was asked whether that should be allowed. And as far as I remember, he said, yes, you know, this is free speech because this is not a direct incitement to kill people like me. And, you know, when you've lived and faced the kind of threats that Rushdie had lived with for decades at that time, you know, standing up for such a principled protection of free speech, I think is admirable, and not many people can live up to those standards. Mm. But I think it's also necessary.
Yeah. So I think your provocative example of Weimar Germany and trying to crack down on Nazis expressing themselves may have ironically made the Nazis even more powerful. That is very provocative. But the underlying...
Sure, and I just want to make... But I just want to make sure that, you know, I'm not trying to explain everything that went on with the rise of Nazism through the narrow lens of censorship and free speech. Many, many other factors were at play, just so the listeners don't get away with
that impression. Sure, sure. But your point is taken about it may have been a contributing factor. And the reason why I circled back around to that is because it's an example of how there will never be a perfect balance, right, between free expression and trying to combat the dangers of intentional provocation that does lead to violence, right? Because we can say that extreme rhetoric is a contributing factor also to the breakdowns of democracy, and people are very worried about that happening here right now in the United States. So what I wonder, Jacob, as we wrap up this conversation, is if we can never find that perfect balance. And yet we also see, you said that you believe there's a recession of free speech culture around the world. What should we be doing now? How do we protect it?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, you know, every time there's a sort of tectonic shift in communications technology that expands the public sphere, that democratizes access to speech, there tends to be disruption and uncertainty, and also sort of backlash in terms of what I call elite panic. You saw that with the printing press and the Reformation that led to bloody persecution and even war. Hopefully we won't be going through the same thing. And you're right, you know, it would be difficult to imagine January 6th and the attack on the Capitol without social media that certainly helped weaponize propaganda and lies about what was going on and leading to the attack. So I still think there are things that we can do. I think one thing is developing a more detached attitude to social media. In many ways, I think we're still acting a bit like the first people who saw pamphlets and saw, oh, if it's written on pamphlets, this must be true. I must, you know, have an opinion on this. And I think that's hopefully something, I think that will take time. We also have to become a lot better at sort of thinking about, you know, what is disinformation and what is not. And then I think a lot of really interesting people are working on ways to foster counter speech, to expose propaganda and so on. So using the good sides of free speech to fight the dark sides.
Mm. But it requires the ability to express yourself to use the good
does.
To fight
free speech
the
bad. Is part of free speech yeah. is part of the solution.
Well, Jacob Mashangama, author of Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. It was a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.